Yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot for the invitation. So today I'd like to talk about some recent developments on the subject of cosmological correlation function during inflation. So the study of this subject, which also goes by the name of primordial non-Gaussianities, it essentially began with a paper of Juan Maldacena in 2002, where he famously computed the inflationary three-point functions arising from pure gravity. Since then, there has been a whole industry of papers trying to compute various types of non-Gaussianities arising from all sorts of interesting inflation models, some of which we hope to measure or constrain better from the future cosmological experiments. So in my today's talk, I decided to talk more about the recent theoretical developments of the subject based on some of the works that I've been involved in with my collaborators. But I also know that some of you here are also interested in more in the model building aspects of the subject, so hopefully we can talk about them offline afterwards. So essentially, the main message that I would like to get across today is that there is a much more efficient way of computing these correlation functions in inflation compared to the standard way of computing Feynman diagrams that never involves writing down any Lagrangians. So of course, this kind of idea is, of course, not very new, but it's in fact ubiquitous in other areas of high energy physics. And this study is actually indeed very much motivated by the parallel S-metric bootstrap program for scattering amplitudes that has been undertaken for many past decades. So it turns out that, as I will describe later in the talk, we can formulate the problem for computing correlation functions in cosmology essentially following a similar logic as a modern way of computing scattering amplitudes. And there seems to be a lot of payoff for this alternative thinking about alternative way of thinking about the problem. So I'll try to demonstrate some of this throughout the talk. So this talk will be based on the paper we wrote together about a year ago, together with Nima Kanihamed, Daniel Baum, and Guy Pimentel, and also a recent paper together with Carlos Duarte-Puello and Austin Joyce. Okay, so before going into the detail, let me back up a bit and then talk a little bit about the background and the motivation. So perhaps the most amazing story to tell about our universe is the fact that all the observable structures that exist in the universe around us, say the cosmic microwave background, galaxies, stars, and us, all have their origin as being tiny quantum fluctuations, which we think were generated in the very early universe during a hypothetical short period of accelerated expansion called inflation. Okay, so for this reason, so cosmology you can think of cosmology as being a historical science. So nobody was around in the early universe to do any sort of experiments, but we only get to see the final structures that exist in the universe today that have emerged and formed throughout the evolution of the universe in a single realization of the universe. Okay? So on the one hand, this might sound bad because, unlike in particle physics, we cannot run the universe over and over again with different initial conditions to learn about new physics. But on the other hand, fortunately for us, the observable universe seems to be quite big enough so that there are enough structures around us that we can access observationally so that we can meaningfully talk about the statistical distribution of these objects in the universe today. Okay. So essentially, the goal of a modern cosmology is to basically try to measure these spatial correlation functions that exist in the late-time universe, and then try to reconstruct the past history of the universe that kind of explains the origin of these correlations in the late-time universe. Okay? So observationally, we have so far measured various types of two-point correlation functions in the late-time universe. For example, the two-point correlation of matter density field, as well as the two-point function of the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. And remarkably, the consistency between the shapes of these two two-point correlations or the power spectra at two different times in the universe agree very well with the theory. So in the standard cosmological model, so the initial conditions for these late-time two-point functions is described by the nearly scale invariant power spectrum of the curvature perturbations that are set at the end of inflation. Okay? So the shape of this initial two-point function is essentially fixed by the symmetries of the inflationary background, which is almost the zero space. Okay. So, for example, scale invariance is fixed by the zero isometries, and there's a small tilt that arises due to a small deviation from being an exact digital background. So far, we have only measured the two-point function in the initial conditions. However, although this measurement of the two-point correlation was very important in establishing the whole inferential paradigm in the first place, at the same time, it is true that this is kind of boring in the sense that this two-point correlation is almost completely fixed by symmetries. Okay? So to learn about anything interesting, so we need to go and measure these higher point correlation functions. Okay? So for example, during inflation, we could imagine that there are some extra particles that are produced by the background, time-dependent background, and then shortly after they could, for example, decay into a pair of inflatons at two different locations that would form non-trivial, say, four-point functions that we could, in principle, observe in the late-time universe today. Indeed, a large part of the experimental programming cosmology in the next few decades is going to be about measuring these various higher-point functions. Okay? We could also imagine there are some self-interacting inflatons that would give rise to this non-trivial type of three-point function. Okay? It's also kind of worth mentioning that the energy scale during inflation or the Hubble scale during inflation, in principle, can be as high as 10 to the 14 GeV. So at this very high energy scales, we could imagine all sorts of particles, extra particles out there, and they're produced by the time-dependent background up to this very high scale of masses of order 10 to the 14 GeV. Okay? So by measuring this correlation function, we would like to answer basically two different types of questions. First of all, what was the spectrum of the particles of the universe up to energy scales of 10 to the 14 GeV? Moreover, it is sometimes, as we have become familiar with the study of scattering amplitudes and other type of observables, it is sometimes also useful to think more conceptually about these observables to learn about the deeper structure of the theory. We'd like to also better understand the analytic structure of these correlation functions, and also ask what kind of consistency conditions that these correlation functions would need to satisfy by the consistency of the theory. So the standard way of computing correlation function in cosmology is, goes by the name of the Inning formalism. Okay, so the name is such a name because we are basically computing in cosmology these in-in correlators rather than computing in-out elements as in amplitudes. Okay? However, this Inning formalism can be pretty complicated if you follow every step of the computation. For example, suppose you want to compute the three-point function of the curvature perturbation zeta. Okay, so what are the procedure of computing this correlator? So actually, the Inning formalism is nothing other than just computing the usual computation of the Feynman diagrams in quantum field theory. So what you have to do is, firstly, to write down the Lagrangian or the action containing the relevant degrees of freedom. Okay, so in the case of the three-point function calculation of zeta, we would need to expand the gravitational action up to cubic order in this zeta variable. Okay, so if you naively do this, then you will get this pretty horrendous expression containing many different terms. But you will quickly notice that many of the terms that appear in this Lagrangian is actually non-dynamical. Okay? So in order to cleanly separate the dynamical versus non-dynamical terms, what you have to do is to, first of all, plug in the constraint equations and then do many sort of integration by parts, and then also make some field redefinition to get removed certain non-dynamical terms. And this can be a very tedious procedure. However, the amazing calculation of Juan Maldacena in 2002 showed that the final answer for this correlator is remarkably simpler than the original Lagrangian that you started with. Okay? So basically, the computation of the three-point function leads to this expression, where up to some local terms that are defined here is basically given by this expression. Okay? So there's a slow roll suppression epsilon, which is the usual slow roll parameter. And then multiplying it is basically some simple function. Okay? So it takes the form of some polynomial in the momentum k1, k2, k3, okay? Divided by the symbol defined as energy, which is nothing other than just the sum over this k1 plus k2 plus k3. Okay? So you see that the final expression is vastly simpler than the original expression you started with. Okay? So this kind of result suggests that the Lagrangian formalism so this simplicity in the final answer is very obscure in the Lagrangian formalism. So it kind of begs for an alternative formalism where this simplicity in the final answer becomes more manifest than the usual Feynman diagram computation. Okay? So in a broader context, this alternative way of computing observables without Feynman diagrams goes by the name of bootstrap. So there is already a lot of different bootstrap methods to compute observables in high energy physics. For example, there's a well-known S-matrix bootstrap program for scattering amplitudes that has been undertaken for many decades, essentially starting from 1960s. So for example, in this method, the idea of the bootstrap method is basically try to use the symmetries of the problem and the singularity structures as much as possible to directly determine observables without necessarily computing Feynman diagrams. Okay? So the reason why the Lagrangian formalism is pretty complicated is that you have to basically keep track of all the Feynman diagrams. Okay? But individually, Feynman diagrams may not have physical meaning. Okay? So in order to gain something sensible physically, you have to sum over many different Feynman diagrams individually, which might not have any physical meaning. And then once you sum over all the different Feynman diagrams, you will get something that is physically meaningful. Okay? So in the S-matrix bootstrap program, you basically try to use the symmetries and singularities to determine the perturbative scattering amplitudes without Feynman diagram computation. So basically, here in cosmology, we would like to follow a similar logic to compute these correlation functions in cosmology without necessarily computing Feynman diagrams. So how does it actually work for the amplitudes? So let's quickly review the structure of the 2-to-2 scattering amplitudes. Okay, involving some external massless scalar fields. Okay, so this would be the simplest example. Okay, so now we have a set of physical principles that would directly dictate the final answer without having to go through writing down Lagrangian and computing Feynman diagrams. So basically, by Lorentz invariance, first of all, the amplitude, the four particle scattering amplitudes, must only be a function of the Mendelssohn variables. Okay, so these are Mendelssohn variables S and T. Which are just the Lorentzian net products of the four momentum variables we have. And then if you have some particle production, like intermediate particles, then we must have some sort of a singularity that would capture the on-shell production of this particle. Okay? And at tree level, this singularity happens to be cannot be more singular than just a simple pole in these Mendelssohn variables S and T. Okay, so this would be just the expression in the S channel. Okay, the location of the pole would be situated at the mass of the particle, intermediate particle in this diagram. Okay. And by unitarity, when you sit on this pole, okay, so when you compute the residue of this pole, you will find that there will be some specific angular dependence associated with each of the three particle amplitudes on each side of the four-point function. Okay, so when you contract and sum over the helicities, you will end up with a specific angular dependence given by this S Lagrange polynomial, where S is the spin of the intermediate particle of this combination of variables, which becomes the scattering angle when you go to the central mass frame. Okay, and then there's a coupling constant squared, which must be positive as a consequence of unitarity. Okay? So although this is kind of very simple example, you can actually compute it using Feynman diagrams, but it's worth emphasizing that no Lagrangian needs to be written down in order to compute this object. You can directly obtain it by using this simple set of physical principles. Okay? Of course, this bootstrap method for scattering amplitude has taken us much further than this simple example. And the frontier of the subject currently involves computing things like multi-leg processes involving multiple loops. Okay? And also, it's worth emphasizing that the study of this subject is also very much driven by experiments. Okay? So we would need accurate theoretical predictions of this amplitude up to, say, a few loops if you want to interpret the observation data coming from the LHC to subpotent level. Okay? So this kind of approach has led to both conceptual and practical consequences. So basically, the question we want to ask now is, what is the analog story for cosmology? Okay. So in cosmology, in the context of inflation, okay, so in near the zero space or inflation, slower inflation, these correlation functions that are located at the boundary of the space-time. Basically, this is the late-time surface during inflation. Okay, they are constrained by approximate or weakly broken conformal symmetry, together with certain singularities that I'm going to explain. Okay, of course, this wouldn't capture all classes of inflation models, and there are indeed many classes of interesting phenomenological inflation models that where the conformal symmetry would not be a good symmetry for the correlation functions. But for the rest of the talk, I will restrict myself to the class of models where conformal symmetry remains a good symmetry for the correlation function. Okay.
So when you say poly K1, K2, K3, is it just any polynomial or is it the one that you showed before?
It's not the same polynomial because I'm computing different diagram, but this is the general structure that you expect from this type of contact interaction report function. Okay? So yeah, the actual form of this polynomial would depend on the particular interaction that we'll be looking at. Okay?
Do you need then the finite diagrams to calculate the actual polynomial?
Yeah, so in this case, actually, this is simple enough that you can actually use the Feynman computation. You follow the Inin formalism procedure to compute this object, but I'm going to show you how you can also obtain this object without Feynman diagrams. In principle, you don't need it, but you can do it both ways. Of course, we are computing the same object, so in principle, there will be two different ways to do it, but I'm going to argue that the other approach is more efficient if you want to compute like more general correlators like the other ones. Okay, very good. So in the rest of the talk, I will restrict myself to the class of inflation scenarios where conformal symmetry remains a good symmetry for the correlation functions. Because those models are where we have a lot of theoretical control over these correlation functions, and so it provides a good starting point to try to initiate this systematic understanding of these correlation functions. Okay. Okay, so as we just discussed, this is the for example, if you want to compute this say 3-point function during inflation arising from this contact interaction, you will basically find that any type of this 3-point function will have this kind of structure, where you will have some epsilon suppression in front, which arises from the fact that you're weakly breaking conformal symmetry. Okay, so you're considering a small departure from the exact set of space time. So that's why you have this small suppression factor in the prefactor. Okay, and the momentum dependence will be given by this polynomial of certain polynomial of k1, k2, k3 divided by some certain power of the energy variable. Okay. So this structure will be kind of universal for this type of contact three-point functions. And then I'll later explain that this three-point function in inflation is really secretly a 4-point function in exact this little background, underlying this little space. So I'll say more about this structure later in the talk. So what is the frontier of the subject in cosmology? So basically, the frontier involves computing this kind of simple 4-point function of massive scalar fields of the amplitons outside, involving some generic particle exchange for generic mass and spin. Okay. We see that our current understanding of this structure of cosmological correlators is very primitive compared to our the knowledge we have for scattering amplitudes, essentially because a little more than a year ago, we didn't. So this object was not known in the literature. Okay. Of course, you can write down some integrals in the Inin formalism for this object and then compute the integrals in certain limits. Nobody was around, was able to compute the integrals in full generality. And then have an analytic understanding of this object. So you're basically, we'd like to obtain some analytic understanding of this object for two reasons. Okay, so there will be our motivation for studying this kind of correlators will be twofold. So first of all, we'd like to provide the exact templates that experimentalists can look for in the data for this kind of processes. So of course, this is four-point function, which is going to be very small. So we will be looking for very small signals, likely swamped by a huge background. Okay? So it will be very useful for us to provide the exact templates that our experimentalists can look for in order to gain as much signal out of possible from the observational data. Another motivation is theoretical. So as with the study of scattering amplitudes, having a systematic understanding of the structure of these kind of correlators might lead to some deeper understanding of the underlying structure of this object. So that's another motivation. So we have both theoretical and practical motivation to study this kind of general correlators. Okay. Right. Essentially, the similar logic holds for both of the diagrams. So if you want to compute the three-point function involving just a particle exchange, you would just take the soft limit, basically setting set one of the moment, take one of the moment, external momentum to zero. Okay, yeah. That's equivalent to setting one of the external legs on the background inflaton field. So I'm going to explain this more about this later.
So you're focusing on weakly coupled theories.
Weakly coupled theory. So this is just a tree level.
But in that case, in practice, we do know the answers for spin less than two easily, and even but for spin two and higher, which I guess is sort of part of it. And then in practice, you actually write down a theory that has massive spin two states, which is weakly coupled. And usually, the cutoff is so low that your last concern is going to be the non-Gaussian entities. Your entire 4D effective theory might be breaking.
Right. So at this level, we are kind of computing these diagrams individually, assuming weakly coupled theory.
Like Klitzer-Klein's the opposite. Example.
Right. We are assuming that the couplings are small.
If the mass is comparable to Hubble.
Right.
You don't even have a 4D description of inflation.
Right. So in principle, you might have to resum all the possible diagrams in order to really capture such a UV complete theory. For the rest of the talk, I will just focus on computing individual diagrams and how these individual diagrams are fixed by this symmetry and singularities.
In the old days, they weren't thinking of some of the poles, they were actually doing branch cuts, right? This is just a decomposition.
Right.
Loop contributions can effectively look like that. Do you have a formalism? If I just sum that up, does that give you what you get?
Well, so far we don't have the answer for the loop diagrams. Our current understanding is basically stuck at this tree level exchange level 4-point function. Is there any other questions? Okay. So that's basically the end of the introduction. So here's the outline for the rest of the talk. So firstly, I'll talk about how we could the idea of doing collider physics in cosmology, which is appropriately called cosmological collider physics, and talk about some qualitative features of this type of correlation functions. And then I'll talk about the bootstrap method for computing this type of correlation functions. And then I will talk about introduce and describe the so-called weight shifting operators, okay, which are some sort of a differential operators that that allows you to compute a general type of correlation function at tree level, starting from a simpler fundamental object. And then, if time permits, I'll end my talk with some future directions. So far, the current observations are described by simply consistent with the simple picture for inflationary scenario, which just involves a single scalar field slowly rolling down the potential in the spectrum. Okay? However, the main challenge of modern cosmology is to basically provide a precise microscopic description of inflationary scenario beyond the single field slow roll paradigm. Okay? So basically, an important lesson from particle physics we should remind ourselves is that basically we can try to understand the structure of the underlying theory at higher energies by detecting some new particles in the lower energies. Okay. So in 2015, Akane Yamada and Magda Sena coined the term cosmological collider physics, and since then, there has been a lot of activities in trying to make this analogy between doing collider physics in ordinary particle colliders and cosmology precise as possible. Okay? So what do we do in ordinary colliders? Well, in order to produce heavy particles in colliders, we first of all collide stable particles and then crank up the central mass energies. And eventually, we will hit the mass threshold for producing these particles. And then if you look at the energy distribution of the decay products, we will see some sort of a spike in the energy distribution of the decaying products that would indicate the production of heavy particle in the scattering processes. Basically, we can determine the masses of this heavy particle produced in the scattering events by looking at the locations of the resonances. Okay, so essentially for cosmology, we have the analytical story, and essentially the analogy is almost perfect. Okay, so during inflation, we can imagine that there's some sort of a pair of heavy particles produced by the inflationary background, and then subsequently decay into a pair of inflatons. Okay, so these heavy particles cannot survive very long outside the horizon because they will basically get diluted due to the rapid expansion of the universe. So they cannot lead to any macroscopic correlations. Okay, so what they need to do in order to form macroscopic correlations is to first decay into this very light, almost massless inflaton fields, which then survives outside the horizon and then eventually re-enter the horizon when the inflation ends to form these structures that we see around us, such as galaxies. Okay? So basically, what we're trying to do is to look for some specific signatures of these heavy particles that are produced during inflation. They will be encoded as some special patterns that we would see in this cosmological correlation function. Okay?
Again, this is very much oversolved because you need the massive particles to mask very close.
Very close window where these heavy particles have masses around the Hubble scale or below. Yeah. Yeah, if it's very heavy, then it will be highly suppressed by the Boltzmann suppression. So yeah, you have to be in the very close window. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so in order to understand this kind of the structure of the correlation functions, we first have to understand how these particles behave in time during inflation. Okay? In particular, since we are computing these correlation functions at very late time during inflation, we only have to understand how these particles behave in the late time limit during inflation. Okay? Or the boundary behavior of a particle. Okay? So this is a very schematic plot that shows the behavior of a scatter particle as a function of conformal time eta, okay? And I'm only showing the superhorizon behavior of this particle, okay? And the particle behaves differently for different type of masses. So for example, if the particle is massless, then basically the fluctuation, the amplitude of the fluctuation becomes frozen outside the horizon. This is why we can observe this correlation function of light fields, like the inflatons. On the other hand, if the particle has some mass, non-zero mass, but still below the Hubble scale, then its fluctuation will decay outside the horizon in a monotonic way like this. Okay? Perhaps the most distinctive case is when the particle is heavy, basically heavier than this threshold 3-Hubble Hubble. In this case, the particle not only decays in its fluctuation, but also oscillates. Okay? So there's a simple way to understand this type of behavior, which you can do by basically taking the free field and then taking the late time limit, eta going to zero. Okay? So when you take this limit, you will basically find that the temporal and the spatial dependencies are factorized in this way. Okay? And the temporal behavior, the scaling behavior in eta, is basically fixed to be this eta to some power delta, where delta I define to be this particular combination. So it's a function of mass of the particle in Hubble units. Okay? And you see why we have this oscillatory behavior for heavier particle, because basically delta becomes complex for heavier particles. So when mass is heavier than 3-Hubble Hubble, then the square root becomes imaginary, so we have a complex delta. Okay, and I'm just going to define this imaginary part of this delta to be I mu. So this is basically why we get this different type of behavior for different mass of the scalar field. Another thing that's worth pointing out is that basically, so I noticed that I used this suggestive notation to denote the spatial dependence of the field in the latent limit, O sub delta. Okay? This is because basically this spatial dependence of the field in the latent limit obeys almost the same properties as some operator in a conformal field theory that has a conformal weight delta. Okay? So basically, if you want to compute late-time correlation function of the field phi, you can basically factor out this overall time dependence and then compute the conformal correlation functions of these operators O, okay, in a conformal field theory. So this is the reason why conformal symmetry can play a very powerful role in inferential cosmology, and I'm going to use heavy use of this fact later in the talk. Okay? So this is basically the time evolution behavior of a scalar field during inflation. And this time evolution behavior is precisely reflected in the so-called squeeze limit of the Drippen function. Okay? So by squeeze limit, I basically mean that if you take the three external momentum and draw a triangle like this due to momentum conservation, the squeeze limit basically corresponds to taking one of the side lengths of the triangle to be much smaller than the other two sides. Okay? So you're squeezing the triangle. And it is very simple to understand what's happening. So first of all, what happens is that so you first have a pair production of these massive particles at some very early time, and at some point that corresponds to scale Q, one of the pair of massive particles will decay into a pair of inflatons. Okay? And at some later time that corresponds to scale Q, K, say, the other massive particle can also decay into a pair of inflatons. Okay? And then you can take one of the inflaton, the external inflatons, to be on the background field. There you obtain the three-point function. Okay? And taking the three-point function, taking the squeeze limit of the three-point function basically amounts to taking the time difference between these two scales to be very large. Okay? So basically, this is the limit where you take, say, Q to be much smaller than K. Okay? So when you compute this three-point function and take this limit, basically, it's almost fixed by kinematics of the problem. So there are various factors that enter in this expression. So for example, so there will be some Boltzmann-like suppression for pair producing these particles out of the vacuum that goes like e to the minus pi mu. So you will see that as was pointed out, for very large masses, this will be highly suppressed, exponentially suppressed. So in order to detect some signature like this, you would have to live in a window where this mu is close to order 1 or less, which corresponds to having particles of masses around the Hubble scale. And you see that this momentum dependence of this Drippen function is also completely fixed by kinematics that reflects the time evolution behavior we just saw previously. Okay? So there's you take the ratio Q over K and take the power 3 halves plus I mu, which is precisely the delta variable that we saw previously. Okay? And the interpretation of this 3 halves factor in the power is basically the dilution of this massive particle with the expansion of the universe that basically goes as 1 over 8 cubed, the scale factor. And you see that there's an oscillatory feature that whose period is precisely fixed by this mass parameter mu. Okay? And if you're exchanging some spinning particle, you can also get the angular dependence, which is given by this S. Legendre polynomial of the cosine of the cosine theta, where theta is the angle between the two momentum vectors. Okay? So this is almost analogous to what we had for scaling amplitudes. Okay? On top of this exponential suppression, you also see that there's a suppression when we go to this squeeze limit because of this real part of this power 3 halves. Okay? So basically, the signal will decay as some soft momentum to the power 3 halves when you go to this squeeze limit. So although this kind of signature is very clean when we go to the squeeze limit, at the same time, the signal is kind of suppressed when we go to the squeeze limit. So this kind of motivates us to try to understand more generally the structure of this.
So you said that's only 3 halves if mu is real, but it could be.
Yeah, this is 3 halves when mu is real, but mu can be imaginary also. So that would correspond to the cases where this mass is less than 3 halves double.
So I guess if I'm just thinking from the point of view of conformal symmetry, delta could be any number. right? But then I guess you're saying that if it's a weakly coupled massive field, that it would be basically 3/2 plus or minus I a real number or just a real number?
Yeah, so basically the real part of delta is bounded above by 3/2, but you can have anything in between 0 and 3/2. So for a lot of fields, yeah.
So if I find a delta which doesn't agree with that, then that says it's not a weakly coupled, I guess, massive particle. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think this relation must hold for weakly coupled particles.
Tree level,
yeah, yeah. There will be some loop corrections, but.
But again, if the mass is so light, you should have just included it in the effective field theory to start with. You completely screw up your power spectrum.
Yeah, sure.
But I mean, isn't there a hierarchy between, hierarchy between the Hubble and the mass of, the mass of inflaton is epsilon times Hubble by.
Yeah, but
I don't think that's going to be enough to do in practice.
Right, okay.
I'm not sure I get your point. You're saying that, so if there is a hierarchy between the mass of the inflaton and why should I worry too much about the direct reaction of this mass?
Well, it's not just about the mass of the inflaton, it's about the typical scale in the theory, right? So the Hubble scale is the scale that sets the dynamics that's going on. And if you have a particle whose mass is comparable to Hubble and it's coupled into everybody, then it can completely change already the background dynamics and two-point function and so on. I mean, in the realistic case, if you do Glitzer-Klein theory, think of this as a spin 2 whose the Glitzer-Klein mass scale is comparable to Hubble, then basically I can't, this is not 4D effective theory anymore because the curvature scale of the problem is exactly the Glitzer-Klein scale, and so I should just solve this in 5D or whatever. I can't trust any of this.
So it depends on the coupling. So you have something.
Depends on the coupling, yes, but basically, yeah, I don't, I mean, you only need, these things have to be coupled in gravitationally. You know, there's no interesting examples where you don't, you know, have such a light state and you don't screw something else up.
Yeah, I don't think there exists UV complete model for this. Yeah, involving the tower of highest spin particles in the spectrum.
So you're pinning yourself down to a weakly coupled thing. Means, well, I could just describe that my effective theory with that state in, which means I can look at the two-point function of those correlators and so on and so on.
We don't have a particular model in our mind, but we are always imagining that the coupling between these extra states and the inflaton is sufficiently weak enough that we can always compute the time and perturbative theory.
Yeah, some kind of weird inflationary dark sector.
We don't have a concrete model in our mind.
If you're about, for example, the consistency of the power spectrum, then you look also at the energy density, right? So.
Yeah, that's right. It's just that there's a point at which it becomes highly tuned, because then what you're doing is saying, you have to imagine the magic that you happen to have other states whose mass is close to Hubble, and yet they're decoupled from the inflation cycle. I mean, it's a hell of a tuning.
But epsilon, isn't it just epsilon making epsilon really small? And apparently there's a big business making
curvature. No, because the curvature is still comparable to Hubble. It's not just about the mass.
You mean epsilon and eta should be, you're saying it's not just, well, I guess you need to make both of them as small, but I guess they can.
So when you're doing this at tree level and you're not including those states, then the cutoff of the theory is basically the masses of those states that you've integrated out.
Yeah, right.
Right, so I'd even worry about curvature corrections in the large effective theory just coming from integrating that layer. Now, of course, you could tune that by making this guy couple particularly weakly, but basically you have to set yourself up into a whole set of magical tunings in order to not have to worry about this in the background.
That's a stupid function. Like, we have examples that it's not like that at all. Like, well, like you can have like a fermion
loop,
like
those. No, fermions, yes, spin lower than 2, but not 2 enough.
Yeah, so I think you can, yeah.
Yeah, 2 enough.
It's easy to do it to lower spins.
Did you say a spin should be bigger than 2?
No, it's for general spin. So yeah, you can always imagine that this particle that you're coupling inflaton to is just a scalar field or spin less than 2.
Once you have spin 2 enough, you don't have it.
We don't have, concrete examples. Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, that I agree, yeah.
So, yeah, your point about especially to spin 2.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, the other case, that's fine. People have done it before in the NN.
There are many scalar field models where.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah, so we are also modifying, because the signal is actually suppressed when we go to the squeeze limit for this massive type of particle, okay, that has these oscillations, we are also motivated to just go beyond the squeeze limit and then try to understand basically the full structure of this four-point function for general momentum configurations. Okay. So when you try to compute this using the usual union formalism, using Feynman diagram, you will basically have this kind of schematic expression. So basically, you will have, in order to compute this object, you basically have to compute some time integrals for each of the interaction vertices. Okay? So there will be two time integrals. And there will be some both boundary propagators that that correspond to the propagators for this external massless inflatons. And then there will be some internal propagator for the particle that you exchange. Okay? For general masses, this propagator takes some complicated form involving some Hankel functions, okay, which are some type of Bessel functions. And unless the particle has a very specific mass, for example, unless the particle is exactly masses, for which this propagator takes an elementary form. So although a little bit tedious, you can actually do this type of integrals analytically. But for general masses, this type of integral is very hard to do in practice, and people, I think, only can do this type of integral numerically in general. So basically, the question we want to ask is whether we could try to obtain some analytic solution for this correlation function using this other way of computing this correlation function. Okay. So let me now describe the method, how we can compute this type of four-point function generally. So the object that we are going to consider is going to be this toy example. Okay? So there will be four-point function with just a scalar exchange with no spin, involving some external fields that are called conformally coupled scalars. Okay? So they have some specific mass in Hubble units given by this twice Hubble squared. Okay, so these are not the ultimate correlation function that we want to compute, which is the four-point function of the massless inflatons. Okay, but the reason why we want to compute this object first is that basically this has more simpler structure than the actual object that we care about. Okay, so basically the reason is that these conformal scalars, from the bulk point of view, have very simple mode functions. So you basically can obtain this object first, and then later I will describe the procedure of how to take this diagram and then compute the actual observable of our interest, which is the four-point function of massless scalars. Okay. So let me now first describe the basic kinematics of the problem. Okay. So we want to compute this spatial correlation function involving four fields phi. Okay. And by spatial translation, you basically get the usual spatial delta function for momentum conservation. So by momentum conservation, you will draw a four-point function in this like this diagram, some quadrilateral involving this four external momenta. Okay. The way the particle physicists would draw this four particle analogous four particle amplitude was it would involve like two particles going in and two particles going out, okay, involving this four momenta. Okay. So in the case of amplitudes, you have an extra delta function for energy conservation as well, because the energy is conserved in this process, scattering process. Okay. But we don't have the analog of the delta function for cosmological correlators, because basically time translation is spontaneously broken, because we are picking preferred time foliation, and then we are computing this correlation function on a specific time slice. Okay. However, there's a specific avatar of this momentum energy conservation that actually takes the form of the singularity in some simple pole or higher, depending on what type of diagram you're computing. But this correlation function will have this universal structure where you have some singularity when you send this e total, which is nothing other than just the sum over the spatial magnitude of the spatial momenta. Okay. Actually, this is not a physical singularity, because you cannot actually reach this pole using physical momenta, because all the magnitudes are basically positive. So you cannot reach the singularity E being exactly zero. Okay? However, you can do this by analytic continuation by taking some of the momentum to be negative. Okay? When you do that and then compute the residue of this energy pole, you will basically find that the residue is precisely given by the flat space scattering amplitudes. Okay? So there's a simple intuitive way to understand this. So basically, when you set E to zero precisely, then it's like imposing energy conservation in flat space, right? So you kind of expect to recover some flat space results, and this is what you have. So this actually puts an extremely non-trivial constraint that the general correlation function needs to satisfy. And I'll explain more about this later in the talk as well. Okay, so that's.
I'm a bit confused. I mean, one of these is Euclidean, the other is Lorentzian. So what are you exactly analytically continuing?
Yeah, so here everything will be in terms of this spatial magnitudes of the spatial momenta. And then you're taking this magnitudes to be some of them to be negative. For example, you would have like k1 plus k2 plus k3 plus k4, and you're flipping some of the signs of the momenta to reach this pole. And then the claim is that the residue at that pole is given by the amplitude. So somehow, this is a completely non-Lorentzian object. Okay? But somehow, when you go to this pole and then take the residue, somehow this momentum combines in such a way that it becomes a Lorentzian variant object.
Is Lorentzian.
This is Lorentzian, yeah.
This is the key, and that's Lorentzian, but it's the same.
Yeah. Okay, so that was basic kinematics, and then what are the symmetries of the problem? So, so in general, we have this the usual spatial isometries consisting of translational rotations. If you're in near the Sitter space or exactly Sitter space, there are going to be four additional symmetries, okay, that are called dilatation and spatial conformal transformations. And imposing these symmetries on the correlation function, the four-point function f, basically leads to the following differential equations. Okay. So basically what happens is that, for example, this is the first line is the constraint due to imposing dilatation. This is actually nothing other than saying that the four-point function has a particular scaling weight under the rescaling of the momentum. Okay? So it actually it's easy to solve the first constraint by basically just pulling out some dimensionful momentum factor and then calling everything else dimensionless. Okay? So here I'm going to pull out this factor the k intermediate defined to be the intermediate momentum, which is the sum over the k1, k2 vectors. Okay, and then I'm going to call this dimensionless function f hat. Okay, defined in terms of the dimensionless variables that are defined to be u and v. Okay, so since I pulled out this factor of ki, this u and v variables will be the sum ratios involving ki's. Okay. And then I'm just going to divide k1 plus k2 for the v variable, and then k3 plus k4 for the v variable. Okay? So these are, right now, these are just some definitions that I'm choosing. Okay? So in general, the four-point function will contain 12 degrees of freedom because we have four types of three-dimensional momentum vectors. Okay? But we have 10 symmetry for the four-dimensional Disler space, okay? So that's gonna end up with just the two physical degrees of freedom that I'm just gonna use these u and v variables to parameterize this four-point function, okay? But it turns out that this kind of the variables is kind of useful for describing the four-point function in the S-channel processes, okay?
Can I ask you, the fact that impulse this conformal symmetries implies that the result you get is correct up to corrections for the reps?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so this will be exactly zero in the exactly conformal case, but in the case of inflation, where you're weakly breaking conformal symmetry, there will be some extra terms on the left-hand side. Okay. That are proportional to epsilon. Yeah. So for now, we're gonna be computing this four-point function in exactly sort of space, and then later I'm gonna tell you how to take that answer to the. You can recover basically, yeah. You can recover the solution involving this epsilon term on the right, left-hand side by taking this limit, self-limit that I'm going to describe. Okay. Actually, the second constraint due to spatial conformal transformation is actually much more trivial because much more non-trivial because it's some second order differential equation that you have to solve, partial differential equation. But it turns out that when you plug in this ansatz to the second equation, you can basically write this complicated equation just in terms of the u and v variable, okay? And when you go through some algebra, you will find that the constraint due to spatial conformal transformation basically can be written in this very compact form, okay? So there's some differential operators, again, some second order differential equations that are defined to be delta u and delta v, okay? Some interesting second order hypergeometric operator, okay? So this is basically the master differential equation that we'd like to solve for different types of physical processes. Okay? So what we want to do is basically try to classify the solution to this master differential equation that would have different physical interpretation from the bulk point of view. Okay? So we're going to start with classifying all the contact interactions. Okay? And then we're going to move on to more complicated tree-level exchange kind of diagrams. And then finally, I'll describe the procedure of how to compute the inflation turbine function from this object. So let's start with the simplest contact diagram. So basically, as I said, all types of physical correlation function must have this kind of universal energy total singularity. So you can imagine the simplest object would be those that only have this kind of E total singularity and nothing else. Okay? And then you can write down some general power of the energy variables, and then the coefficient here in terms of the UV will be completely fixed by conformal symmetry. Okay? And then it turns out that the simplest solution that satisfies this the master differential equation that I showed you is basically just given by 1 over E, and that's it. And then you can build like all the higher order solutions by simply acting with this delta U operator multiple times. Okay? So this will be in flat space, this will be analogous to just having various powers, polynomials in the Mendelssohn variables that will describe the contact interactions. Okay?
So this is an expansion in flat space. Is it like a high energy or low energy expansion?
Yeah, so here actually there will be some mass suppression as well. So this is like the EFT expansion. So there will be some 1 over m squared suppression for each of the nth term. So in practice, only the lowest term would matter. It's essentially the same story for amplitudes, right? Because you can have these higher derived contact terms that are suppressed by some extra mass scales. So in practice, it will be mostly dominated by the leading order. It gets higher powers of E, yeah, because E in terms of the U and V variable is something like 1 over U plus V.
It goes the opposite way, the lower energy. But if you want to say we're going to go to large energy.
Yeah, this is kind of confusing because E is really, the E singularity really exists in the unphysical region. So in the high energy limit, when you take this E to zero, you kind of expect that the high dimensional operator would contribute more in this limit. But in the physical region, because there's a mass suppression and you're not reaching the singularity, this type of diagram will be mostly dominated by the leading.
It looks like it's really high energy is what you're so the EFT is for large E, not for a small E, right? Because you have negative power with the E over there and you have positive power with the left.
Right, yeah, so in some sense, the EFT expansion is the region where E is not too small.
Yeah.
Okay, so now having classified all the contact interactions, we also want to look at the exchange diagram. Okay, so basically, you'll find that the previous master differential equation that we had basically becomes separated into two different ODEs in U and V separately. Okay, so this is the four-point function. You act with this operator, differential operator, and you will basically get the contact term as the source term on the right-hand side. Okay, so there's an intuitive way to understand this diagram. For example, so if you take the high the large mass limit of this intermediate particle, you will basically be able to integrate out the intermediate particle, after which you expect the diagram to be dominated by the contact interaction like this at low energies. This is what precisely happens here. When you take M to be large, you can basically ignore this differential operator, and these two diagrams become proportional to each other. Okay? So basically, what these operators do to this diagram is that basically this is like the analog of the box operator hitting the propagator inside, but these are the analog of that box operator acting on the outside legs. Okay? So when you act with the box operator on the propagator, it doesn't matter whether you act on this particular vertex or this particular vertex. Okay? You basically collapse the propagator into a delta function that would give the contact interaction. So this is why you also get two types of ODEs in U and V separately that basically gives the same object. Okay? So this is also very analogous, very much analogous to what we have for scattering amplitudes. So basically, if you have a tree-level exchange, four particle amplitudes, and then multiply by the inverse propagator, s minus m squared, because this at tree level, this is the all the singularity is contained in the simple pole, by multiplying with by the inverse propagator, you basically end up with some analytic function on the left, right hand side, given by this bunch of contact terms. So we have very similar structure. So now our task is basically try to solve this ODE in the U variable, either in the U variable or the V variable. And we see that this differential equation is second order. So in order to uniquely fix the solution, we have to set two boundary conditions precisely. Okay? So so these are the boundary conditions, for example, we can choose. Okay? So we can, for example, if you go to the so-called folded limit, where you're basically sending two of the external momentums to be collinear with each other, okay? You'll find that the general solution will have some singularities when you take this limit. Okay? However, if you assume some bunch Davis initial conditions, you don't expect any type of singularities arising when you take this limit. So in bunch Davis initial conditions, there shouldn't be any singularity as you send u and v to 1. So this is one of the boundary conditions that you are imposing to fix the condition, to fix the solution. And another boundary condition we can choose is, for example, by going to the collapse limit. In this limit, we kind of expect a four-point function to be kind of factorized into a product of three-point functions. Okay, so another boundary condition we choose is to normalize the solution correctly in this limit so that it becomes a product of the three-point functions. Okay? So doing so would uniquely fix the solution. And let me just show you the solution in the small u limit for simplicity. Okay, but the physics will be essentially the same for the general solution. Okay, so we have two kind of parts of the solution. Which physically you can interpret as the EFT expansion and the particle production piece. Okay? So the first piece, if you look at it, is some series expansion. You can also call this hypergeometric function if you wish. Okay? But if you look at the coefficient of the series expansion, you find that it goes as one of mu squared for a very large mass that basically goes as h squared or m squared. This is the usual EFT expansion you would expect. Okay? And the momentum dependence is analytic, so it's some contact interaction. And the second piece has this interesting one over cost factor that would become exponentially suppressed when you go to the large mass limits. So this is basically the piece that arises from particle production. And then you find that the solution has this interesting oscillatory dependence in the momentum variables, whose frequency is fixed by this mu variable. Okay. So basically, when you plot this, this is what you basically get. So it's interesting to make the analogy between usual colliders and cosmological collider. In the usual collider, you basically, at low energy, you will have some EFT description of the amplitude. And then once you produce the actual on-shell particle, you will find that the energy, there's a peak in the scattering amplitude that you identify the resonance for particle production. In cosmology, you have something similar. You start from the equilateral region, and then in this region, everything will be mostly dictated by the EFT parts. And then when you kind of collapse the quadrilateral, you start to see this kind of oscillatory behavior. There would be kind of the fingerprint of the particle production of these heavy particles during inflation. Okay.
So can I ask, would this be a generic statement just for CFD, or I mean, just ideas. But I'm not necessarily because I mean, presumably this is. I mean, this is just CFD, or so it's basically some holographic correlation function that we could. So with these massive particles in the bulk, you could think of it as some bulk theory, and then you're doing the calculation in the boundary theory. So I'm just thinking, this kind of oscillations is something people have seen elsewhere in the bulk, for example.
I'm not sure if people have considered this type of oscillatory signal in the context of holographic cosmology. You mentioned ADS-CFT, but this other type of behavior will only be present in the DS case.
Right, so you think it's a specialty DS-CFT and not ADS-CFT?
Yeah.
Because it's a non-perturbative effect, I suppose, so it may be something that's trivial, yeah.
We could talk about it, yeah. Okay, and then you can also find the angular dependence, specific angular dependence given by the Legendre polynomial as you scan this shape of the four-point function. Okay. And then you can also find that the singularity at this E total singularity is basically given by this Lorentz invariant combination of the momenta that basically becomes 1 over S, Mendelstam variable. Okay, so since I'm running out of time, let me just quickly say that there's a So basically, the so far we have
five or ten.
Okay, yeah, great. So basically, we have so far computed this four-point function of some toy model involving conformal scalar fields. There's a simple procedure involving some differential operator acting on this four-point function that will take this diagram and then give the four-point function of the massless fields as an output. Okay. And it turns out that there's a simple way to construct this sort of set of so-called right shifting operators in embedding space using some CFD techniques. But I'll mostly skip this. So basically, you can derive the relevant right shifting operators to that acts on the scalar exchange solution that we saw previously to generate all the spin exchange solutions for arbitrary spin. And the nice thing is that we have a closed form expression for this right shifting operator for generic spin and helicity. So you also have the analog corresponding closed form expression for the spin exchange solution. Okay? And then you get some angular dependence. Now, in order to really compute the inflationary three-point function, okay, what you have to do is to remind that inflaton is not exactly massless, but has a small mass, okay, basically epsilon times the Hubble. So this effect can be incorporated as kind of making a small deformation of one of the dimensions of the operators on the external legs by shifting them by epsilon amount, and then taking the soft limit k4 going to 0. Okay? So you find that basically, to obtain this correlator involving massless fields, you have to apply these right shifting operators, okay? One for the 1-2 leg, and then the other one for the 3-4 legs. Okay? What happens when you make this deformation and then take the soft limit is that one of them just becomes constant, basically given by the epsilon that you're deforming. And then taking the soft limit basically amounts to taking one of the variables, like v equal to 1. Okay? So there's a simple prescription of going from the four-point function to the inflationary three-point function. And then you can kind of write down the most general expression for the inflationary three-point function in the limit where interactions don't break conformal symmetry strongly by this sum over all the four-point functions with different spins and contact diagrams with arbitrary coefficients in this way.
What were these
W12s? So this would be the weight shifting operator that, sorry, I skipped many of the details, but this would be the operator that would kind of raise the weight of the external operators by one unit. Okay. So
how does it look like? Is it like a
some second order differential operator that I can write down for you later. And these are some examples. So basically, starting from a simple object, some seed function, you can apply various types of weight shifting operators to obtain, to basically reproduce many different results in the literature. Okay. So basically, this is a summary that basically we have initiated a systematic study of this type of correlation functions in the regime where we have weakly coupled conformal symmetry. And then starting from some fundamental object, we could try to obtain the inflationary three-point function and four-point function using these various types of phase shifting and spin ranging operators. So let me just mention one interesting application of this formalism, which is about computing these spinning correlation functions. Okay. In particular, we will be interested in computing correlation function involving the external gravitons, okay, which are basically hardly known beyond three-point function. Okay. So the idea would be to find and apply some differential operator that this time increases the spin of the external operators, and then impose the conservation to basically uniquely fix this correlation function for the graviton. Also, interestingly, this correlation function, even though I didn't mention, satisfies some different factorization behaviors. So, so for the scattering amplitudes, we know that when you go to the simple pole for particle to make the intermediate particle on shell, we know that the four particle amplitude will be factorized into a product of three point three particle amplitudes. Something very similar happens for cosmological correlators. Basically, by going to these various types of energy singularities, you will find that the four-point function will basically become factorized into a product of three-point function and three-point amplitudes, depending on which singularities you go to. So by using this factorization procedure, by demanding consistent factorization behavior for the four-point function, we hope to find some sort of a cosmological analog of the usual four-particle test for amplitudes we have in flat space. So in flat space, we know that demanding this consistent factorization for amplitudes leads to very strong consequences. So basically, if you demand a consistent factorization behavior for four particle amplitude involving massive spin one or spin two fields, you'll basically find that the only consistent amplitude is the one from the Young-Mills theory and Einstein gravity and so forth. Okay? So we'd like to find some sort of an analogous four-point function test for cosmological correlators. Okay? This is something work in progress. So basically, we expect some similar type of constraints for the cosmological correlators. And for example, we should see from this test, we should see something wrong with having supersymmetry for cosmological correlators, because the supersymmetry must be spontaneously broken in a cosmological background. And for example, we could try to understand the consistency or the inconsistency of some interesting higher spin theories that could exist in this little space as well. So let me try to end with a final remark. So basically, we've seen that there exists similar bootstrap programs in high energy physics, and cosmological bootstrap involves kind of an influx of ideas from various other bootstrap programs, and we kind of expect this program to have various interesting applications. For example, in holography, or more practically, in the search of primordial non-Gaussianities in future observations, and we see that this kind of understanding, our current understanding of cosmological correlators, is very primitive compared to our knowledge for scattering amplitudes. So we have many years to catch up. So hopefully, trying to explore this program better will keep us busy for some time. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
There are no more questions.